Legislators get set to study property taxes, but first, they have some homework to do. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, March 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Lee Strubinger summarizes the Legislative Research Council's overview of tax policy. We'll look at updates over the years and some of the challenges ahead for lawmakers promising lower tax burdens. USD is hosting a democracy conference. We'll talk with a research fellow about waning trust in American elections. Our Dakota political junkies tackle issues of academic freedom, along with President Donald Trump's battle with the federal judiciary. Plus, why the price of coffee is heating up and the tension between home buyers and short-term rental owners in the Black Hills. Those stories are a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. During the 2025 legislative session, another chapter was added to the long history of property tax legislation in the state of South Dakota. This year, our Legislative Research Council prepared a report outlining every time property taxes have changed since 1989. Now, SDPB's Lee Strubinger is going to bring us highlights from the report with insight into what present-day lawmakers might be learning from the past. Strubinger is SDPB's politics and public policy reporter. He joined me from our Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
There was an election last year, and lawmakers say that the number one thing they heard while they were on the campaign trail, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, is why are property taxes so high? This will be like the third property tax-related summer study in about 4 years. But, you know, really since about 2018, South Dakota has seen a very steady and significant rise in property tax values, especially post 2020 and the COVID-19 pandemic. So even if mill levies kind of remain the same, which is basically like what taxing districts will, the kind of rate that they'll tax you at, if your property sees a significant increase in value, that will be reflected in your property tax bill. And again, that's really jumped since the pandemic. So you might ask yourself, like, why property taxes?
Yeah.
Again, you know, the two largest sources of revenue for governments in South Dakota are sales taxes and property taxes. We don't have an income tax, so it's really just like primarily those two. The state government doesn't receive any property taxes, but they receive mostly sales taxes. Cities are also able to receive some sales taxes as well, but schools and counties really heavily rely on property taxes. And, you know, according to a recent paper that was put out by the LRC before the legislative session started, you know, this is an issue that has dogged the state for decades. And it seems like, to me anyways, as I was reading it, that this is really kind of something that crops up about once every 10 years.
All right. History lesson. Where do you want to begin?
Yeah, let's go back to maybe the 80s and early 90s.
Okay.
During that time, there were about four separate ballot measures that were related to kind of capping property taxes. They were all defeated. But the issue really came to a head in the 1994 election when Initiative 1 was narrowly defeated. Okay. It would have freezed assessments and capped them at those current levels at about 1995. And they could only change when property changed ownership, which was kind of an idea that was floated and got pretty far in the legislative process this year. So part of the tension during that time was there were no limits or constraints in state statute for the total amount of property tax revenue generated from levies. There was no state oversight or regulation. So then gubernatorial candidate Bill Janklow promised voters that if they rejected the measure, he would bring property tax relief.
Mm.
So the first year that I want to talk about is 95. The legislature enacted Janklow's property tax reduction program. It did several things. Like I said before, prior to this change, there were no constraints on the amount of revenue generated from levies. This law essentially capped and limited what taxing districts were able to raise from property taxes at 3% or inflation, whichever is less. And that's still the same to this day.
Okay.
It also started a process where the state legislature sets the school district's maximum levy. So you have taxing districts at like the county level, but then you also have school districts. And then this also led to property tax relief through broadening the state's sales tax base. You'll recall that this was kind of one of the arguments against removing the state sales tax on food, that it would narrow that broad-based sales tax regime. And then there were also some increases in video lottery collections. And so the kind of increase in those collections, and this, it also established kind of like a new sort of complicated formula of state aid to school districts that very few, especially me, fully understand in and out. But this essentially kind of set up our modern education funding and property taxes and for these taxing districts are all very intricately linked together. And it worked well for some time, at least in the realm of keeping property taxes steady.
So people thought Governor Janklow kept his promise. They defeated the initiative measure and he took some kind of action.
Yeah, property taxes. He promised to try and get property taxes down by about 30%. It took him a couple years and he eventually got to that point and right in time for re-election.
Okay, and you said it worked well for some time. All right, what happened next? Yeah,
it did. And it worked well partly because of declining K-12 enrollment in schools.
Okay.
So South Dakota has a per student allocation. So the declining enrollment partially offset the state and local effort that had to go towards essentially increased costs per student. And this is a quote from the LRC paper that was released last year that beginning in fiscal year 2008, so that's when the trend of K-12 student enrollment reversed, it started to increase annually. And while that happened, the state's share of funding decreased, thereby increasing the property tax dollars required to fund school districts. And it's kind of increased steadily ever since. In fiscal year 2008, the local effort, so what folks are taxed in their taxing districts on their property taxes, was $258 million. And in the most recent fiscal year, it was over $455 million dollars in property taxes were required to meet that local effort for schools.
Okay, so changes, people were complaining, changes were made. And then as the enrollment goes up, you need more money and the property taxes go up. Do I understand that fundamentally?
Yes.
All right. Some of those changes were made in 1995, but you mentioned at the beginning here that about every 10 years, something pops up. Jump ahead a little bit. What happened next?
I won't dive into it too much, but basically the state legislature changed the way that agriculture land is taxed. So I'm going to paint with a really broad brush stroke here, but essentially it was really hard in about the 2008 era, middle aughts, to assess ag values because there were so few transactions to really base it on. It wasn't like people weren't selling their farms. And so the state was basically in like a market system. Like what does the market say this ag land is worth? It moved from that market system to a productivity system. And it uses the kind of income value that agriculture property can generate. And they take basically 8 years worth of data and they do the Olympic average, which is they move the highest value and the lowest income value in that 8 year span time period. And they kind of average the middle for those particular property taxes. And that really was also like a really big change. Like Governor Roden talked about that this year in press conferences and how, you know, basically overnight the property taxes that he experienced in Meade County went up by about like 50%.
Oh, okay. Then what?
Flash forward to 2015, about 10 years later.
Yeah,
and we have the Blue Ribbon Task Force that was established by Governor Dennis Dugard to really look at school funding. And it did several things with the aim of increasing teacher salaries.
Mm-hmm.
It raised the state sales tax by half a penny. And then 2/3 of those dollars went to increasing those teacher salaries through the education funding formula. And the other 1/3 went toward reducing property taxes through kind of the school district general fund levies. Again, it's kind of a complicated formula, but it's basically an extension of the kind of modern education funding formula that we talked about a little bit earlier by just putting more dollars towards schools and property tax relief.
All right. So what's driving the rise in property taxes in the state now?
This is really hitting like a handful of counties. So you have like Minnehaha, Lincoln, and the counties in the Black Hills.
Okay.
But basically, as values go up, again, if levies remain the same, property taxes will also go up. This year, the state legislature passed a bill limiting assessment growth at 3% for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, it does like a number of other things, like increasing the limits on who qualifies for a property tax freeze, et cetera. The idea being they want to sort of put this in place and kind of tamp down on the particular growth that we're seeing in these counties to see if it kind of levels out and steadies. You also have the property tax funding formula from the 90s bumping up against the kind of post-COVID reality of inflation. I was looking at some data that was in this paper and from the Department of Revenue that basically from 1997, when that 3% cap was put in place, the inflationary increase factor, that 3% that taxing districts can capture, they've really only reached that limit like a handful of times during that time period. So from essentially the COVID pandemic onward, taxing districts have been capped at 3% and bringing in that 3%, while inflation has been much higher and sometimes double. So the state isn't really affected much because, you know, sales tax collections will reflect inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a former property tax study found that 80% of county obligations are mandated by the state. So they're facing these increased costs and they have to meet the demands that are required of that particular government, but they really lack the revenue to pay for those services.
So how will the new interim study then address property taxes that face the state right now?
That will depend on who is on the study, and that's really yet to be determined. And their
you mean
their
like first, the people, the groups that are invited,
the lawmakers that are on it, yeah. And that kind of makeup has yet to be determined, and their first meeting hasn't been announced either. Mm. But one of the things you can see even just in the title of the group, it's to provide for property tax reductions.
Yeah.
And so when you talk to a lot of folks, they say that can be accomplished one of three ways. By either shifting property taxes onto another classification like agriculture or commercial, which that seems to be a non-starter for many, by increasing taxes elsewhere like sales taxes and putting it towards property tax relief, that was an idea that failed in this past legislative session, or by cutting spending. And, you know, like I mentioned just a little bit earlier in terms of what county governments are obligated to provide, they're saying that their cash flows are very, very limited. You know, there is like another argument that economic growth can help lower levies, you know, with more of a certain property on taxing rolls that can kind of spread things out a little bit more. But many in this current Republican majority have signaled skepticism of that really working.
That was SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. You can find all of his reporting at sdpb.org/news. The Cheeseman Center for Democracy at the University of South Dakota will host its annual Democracy Conference tomorrow. That's Thursday, March 27th. This year's conference focuses on Americans' faith in our elections. It's a subject Lisa Bryant knows well. She'll deliver the keynote address, Skepticism, Trust, and Confidence in Elections. But first, she joined me via Zoom to preview the all-day conference. Also joining us, Julia Helweg. She is Distinguished Professor at USD and Director of the Cheeseman Center.
So my fellowship is on the role that partisanship has had, and particularly partisan polarization, has had on how we run elections and how people view their local election officials. And in response to sort of hyper-partisanship and some orchestrated efforts to, let's say, sow the seeds of doubt in elections, how have election officials across the country responded? And so the Carnegie Fellowship this year, the focus was on polarization. And when people think of polarization, they think a lot about what the students will probably be talking about. They think about partisan polarization in the electorate. But my research is really looking at how partisan polarization is impacting the processes and the way that we run elections and how that's affecting essentially bureaucrats who, by and large, act in a very nonpartisan manner in their official capacity.
Who benefits from sowing the seeds of doubt? Does anyone?
I think that there's a short-term gain and there's long-term consequences. So I think that partisans in maybe competitive districts see the potential to have short-term partisan wins or at least mobilize individuals to maybe vote in the next election because they feel that they were wronged with the outcome of a particular election. I think if we look at the long-term impact in not only the ability to keep public servants in their positions and the desire of people to go into public service, we see a marked decrease in the number of people who want to stay in these positions and who want to enter the field. But we also see really a long-term effect on the electorate in a decline in trust in our elections. You know, we've seen, and this is kind of going to be a theme of my talk, is there's been a decline in trust in a number of elections. Everybody knows, you know, almost nobody trusts Congress as a whole, even if you like your own member of Congress. We've seen a decline in trust in the president. And then we saw the courts start to slip. And the courts for a long time, you know, were stable. We've seen the courts start to slip in trust. And now we've seen even like your local election officials, your neighbors, your friends, people your kids go to school with, there's a decline in trust in their ability. And so we're just seeing institutions all the way down have a decline in trust. And so I think one of the long-term consequences of polarization and at least hyperpolarization is this sort of decline in trust in all systems.
What is your research showing you about how it impacts the human component of just having one of these jobs, the workload, the how you feel about your job, how long you might want to stay at it, what you felt the point of it was? Tell me a story about what you've learned.
So those are all great questions, and those are all questions I can answer with data in my research. We've seen that local election officials, and I'm not talking state secretaries of state, just local election officials, they feel overwhelmed in their jobs right now. And some of the stories are really about they're having to make reforms, but they're not reforms that necessarily make elections better or more secure. So many of them are focused on personal safety, right? Like increasing safety for poll workers who are out on election day at voting locations, increasing safety for their staff because there's increased threats, there's increased harassment. And so they're taking resources that might otherwise go into running the election and having to put them into physical security barriers and things like buying emergency wristbands for poll workers so that if somebody comes and starts to harass or threaten them, they can immediately, you know, beckon the sheriff's department. And the other thing is that the misinformation that is led by pretty orchestrated efforts is leading to an increase in freedom of information records requests, which consumes their staff's time and also takes up resources, so they can't be doing other things that the office is responsible for. And several election officials have said it's also made them have a decreased pride in their work, right? They don't want to tell people what they do for a living anymore. They don't want to say, I'm your county clerk or I'm your registrar of voters. So they just start telling people, I work for the county or I work for the government. And you know, as a political scientist, I don't know, Dr. Helwig can say this, I can relate. And so I'm like, when I'm on a plane and I'm trapped next to someone, I always just say I'm a teacher. So it's really, I can sympathize with how they're feeling about this.
Yeah. Dr. Helwig, tell me a little bit about one of the opportunities of the conference and the work that you're doing at the University of South Dakota and with the Cheeseman Center. After the conference is over, the potential for research that might be sparked by Dr. Bryan's talk, for example, are you hoping that there will be generative research that is focused specifically on South Dakota elections, for example?
Well, absolutely, and it's actually already happening behind the scenes. So we do a poll with South Dakota Newswatch every semester, usually in about October and about May. We're gearing up for our next one now. And so that allows us to do a public opinion poll, talk about elections, talk about the state of democracy here in South Dakota. And some of the work that Dr. Bryan's been doing on polarization has really inspired me to add more questions about trust in government and election administration. And that's been really interesting. And so from that, we produced a democracy report a few years ago that was before any of these conversations with Dr. Bryant. But we have continued that work. And so as we're adding more questions and as we are getting very interesting and maybe concerning answers about the state of democracy and people's trust in government, we've continued to develop initiatives that seek to improve the state of democracy and trust. And then we have also pushed on our research side. So I have had the opportunity to add some of my questions then that we received from South Dakota and that we had from our podcast that we did with STPB, Dakota Dialogues, some of those conversations that have come out of the report and these conversations. We then added those questions, and we're hoping to see some of those results coming up soon. And so it's really been, I don't know, a continuous circle, like gears turning regularly, right? So it's been interesting to see how we've been playing off of each other from the national to the local, from the research to the program initiatives and between scholars.
I'm wondering, Dr. Bryant, if you're noticing any sparks of what works to restore trust, because hey, trust me, why don't you trust me, is not going to be enough in the age of information that we have. So are there actions that voting officials or voters or voter organizations are taking to restore that trust?
One thing I always say is, you know, be involved, right? Be a poll worker, be an election worker, because if you don't trust the system and you don't think there is a very well spelled out chain of custody of the ballots or of how elections are run, one of the best ways that you can learn is by participating. And not everybody could be a poll worker, but if you find yourself being drawn to believe sort of into some of the skeptical side of things and the claims, then sign up to be a poll worker, right? Because I think that that's one of the best experiences people can have to see how secure our systems are. And if there are breaches in the system, identify what they really are rather than sort of rely on these rumors that tend to circulate, especially on social media.
The Cheeseman Center for Democracy holds its annual Democracy Conference on Thursday, March 27th. It begins at 9 a.m. local time and runs through 3:30 p.m. We'll have links on our website where you can learn more. That's sdpb.org/news. Up next, the Dakota Political Junkies explore how Donald Trump is using his executive power. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Trump administration has delivered an ultimatum to Columbia University in New York City. Federal officials told the private university to place its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African studies departments under academic receivership. Now, critics of the university say it's a necessary move to address anti-Semitism on campus. Critics of the Trump administration say it is an attack on academic freedom and an attack on the First Amendment rights of Americans to speak out about international policies. Now, our Dakota political junkies are going to join us to unpack the unprecedented move. David Wiltsey is a professor of political science at South Dakota State University. Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science, also at SDSU. And they sat down in the SDPB Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings. I want to start today with a college out of New York City, Columbia University, because of this idea of an academic receivership. And that was new to me. Dr. Hager, do you want to start with what you're seeing the federal presidential administration saying their role is in fixing what they perceive as problems at a public university?
Right. So I saw that the federal government wants to put the Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department under receivership for a minimum of 5 years. And there's some differing interpretations floating around as to what that actually means in practice. So what we've seen so far is that this is in response to anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian protests that are taking place at the campus, and then this discussion of whether that is promoting anti-Semitism. And so it's kind of an interesting concept just because of the fact that when I necessarily think about receiverships, I'm thinking about it in terms of financial reasons. And so that's why there's some oversight that is needed. But instead, we're seeing these oversight needs for other reasons pertaining to what I would say the administration is chalking up to discrimination-oriented issues.
And so as I read the articles about this, and again, we're a long ways from New York City, so we're looking at it through reading the news like everyone else is, but I'm also not seeing a failure of an academic program to fuel students into jobs or to prepare them for the workforce or to do. It's specifically that the university, according to the Trump administration, did not protect students from anti-Semitism. and therefore these departments are being overlooked. Dave Wiltsie, what are you seeing in here? Is there connective tissue between the charge of anti-Semitism run rampant and the receivership that the administration is proposing?
Well, there's certainly some pretty nasty things that have happened at Columbia. I mean, there's no doubt there. Certain incidents, particularly some professors that have been drilling students that they think are Jewish or what have you. But I don't know if it's quite the job of the academic department to go out and protect students from any kind of physical act, any kind of protest like this. That seems to be more of something you do with campus security. This really is something that we've never seen before. Mm. And it really just seems like score settling more than anything. I don't think it can be justified on any legal grounds so far that I've seen. It's not akin to, you know, police departments that have gone into receivership because of civil rights violations against their own citizens. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Columbia's a private institution, no?
Yeah, I said public. I think it's private, yeah. I misspoke earlier.
You know, so, you know, here we have, you know, the federal government coming in and trying to regulate a private higher educational institution, mm-hmm. which is just, I've never seen anything like it. And it's disturbing.
It is sounding alarm bells for legal scholars and colleges across, because Columbia might be the example, but the mm-hmm. president is not intending to stop there. And so there are many people who are deeply concerned about what this means for academic freedom. When we say mm-hmm. academic freedom, what are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the ability of people like myself, Lisa, other professors across the country to go out and pursue their research in whatever field they're practicing in and disseminate that information freely. And what we're seeing here is, you know, a pretty clear case of harassment, trying to squelch those basic academic freedoms. And if they can get away with it on a private campus like Columbia, and as prominent and wealthy of a campus as Columbia, where couldn't they do it?
The chilling effect of that, Lisa Hager.
Right, and I think that's really the natural connection. So academic freedom has always been protected by the First Amendment. And so naturally, when you start to see attacks on academic freedom, it will have a chilling effect in the sense that people, in this instance, obviously faculty members, administrators, staff, are going to feel like they are not able to say the things that they would normally say, not research the things they would normally research, not disseminate that research in that way, not teach the things they would typically teach within the classroom. So people will be altering their behavior most likely based on what we're seeing occur at Columbia.
I read an article where Jelani Cobb in the New York Times, where they were in a room and the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, which is one of the preeminent journalism schools in the country, told his students, if you were on a student visa, stop writing about anything that has to do with Palestine or Israel, or the arrest or the detainment and deportation of students and former students from this institution. He got some pushback, and he said, according to the New York Times article, I cannot protect you. And that is astonishing to me as a journalist, that you would hear the Columbia head of journalism say, don't report on this because
right.
mm-hmm. I cannot protect you from the consequences of reporting on the story.
Well, and I think that's where you see folks in those types of positions having to really advise students about what they should be doing. And I would expect there's probably administrators who feel like they need to advise their faculty on what yeah. to do in those situations. Just goes back to that chilling effect that it's having.
Yeah. And again, I'm reading the New York Times most of my, because the Columbia is in New York, I've been getting most of my information from those reports. I have not spoken to anybody in administration or education at Columbia. But I mentioned deportation, and I want to jump ahead to another topic, which is the judicial pushback on President Trump's and Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Kristi Noem's acts of detaining and deporting people, especially this student, former student, graduate of Columbia, who had legal status, had a green card, was a green card holder in the U.S. and the deportation of flights to Venezuela that a federal judge said, you know, we need to stop this. So essentially the big theme here, without getting into the weeds for every little case that's happening, is the judiciary and the role of the judiciary in checking the power of the executive branch. So again, take us into the classroom. What is the judiciary's role? Who do they report to?
Yeah, so whenever I start explaining the issue of judicial review to students, I always remind them that we're not just talking about the courts checking Congress and the legislation that they're putting into place, but it's also checking the executive branch and more formally the president and his actions. And so I think that's like the first thing that a lot of folks are noticing with respect to this is, oh yeah, there's that aspect of what's the relationship between the courts and the president. And so, yeah, we're seeing the courts pushing back on a variety of different issues. And I think there's just a lot of sorts of issues we're going to see continue coming before the courts. And I think that's what a lot of the ultimate goal is for folks.
Yeah. When somebody asked me the other day, well, how can one federal judge be more powerful than a president? And I said, that's kind of the point. This is how this works, that there are federal judges who are paying attention to the law. How would you explain that, Dr. Wilsey, if someone said, well, how can one federal judge from a state, you know, in mm-hmm. wherever, stop a president from doing what he wants to do?
Right. The very first thing I would say is it's not just one judge, because that judge's decision is subject to review. Mm-hmm. And then there's a panel of judges in an appellate circuit that's going to hear that. And then their decision is going to be subject to review. So it's not just an individual, it is an entire institution that is providing review. That one judge is just a step along the way. And obviously, if the higher court wants to hear it, they will hear it, or they can just abide by the ruling that the district judge made. But it's not about a single judge. This is about undermining the judiciary. And unfortunately, they are pushing in every way that they can in issue after issue, particularly when it comes to the use of a very broadly defined executive authority. Mm. And that's the long and short of it.
And threats have come that individual judges should be impeached or removed from office. Is that possible? Can the president do that?
No. So impeachment is something that originates in Congress. And so the president can definitely call for that. Yeah. That's not something where it's unprecedented per se. But no, the president cannot single-handedly remove a federal judge from office.
South Dakota State University political scientists Lisa Hager and Dave Wiltsey joined us for our Dakota Political Junkies analysis this week. You can listen to the full interview wherever you get your podcasts. Search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to close the hour out by checking in with SDPB reporters as they bring you news from across the state. First up, Jackson Dirks. He has been talking with farmers and ranchers about the impact of tariffs and trade uncertainty in 2025 so far. You can find his work on sdpb.org/news. Jackson Dirks joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
There was some funding that Congress kind of allocated back in December. This is now actually available. So it's been kind of an ongoing process of trying to get funding and stuff like that just to kind of get relief from inflation. And it's just now available. Though the funding is welcome, like it's needed in the ag industry right now, especially in South Dakota, people are kind of pumping the brakes a little bit because they don't want funding to come from the government. They want it to come from the markets.
So they're seeing still the residual effects from the trade war with China mm-hmm. and soybeans. Some of those markets have not come back. And mm-hmm. now there's new tariffs, but that's a little hard to follow mm-hmm. because sometimes the tariff is proposed, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily implemented or it's delayed. Are they feeling uncertain?
Yes, would be the easy answer, 100%.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody kind of knows what's going to come. The industry is just in this area where we don't know what's next. So a lot of the farmers are worried about tariffs that could be coming. And the whole thing we keep hearing from the Trump administration is just we're negotiating. We're getting negotiations. Like, originally it was kind of to secure the border. They wanted border security. That's what Trump wanted. And so then whenever some of that was employed, more tariffs are still there. So it's just at a spot where people don't know what's coming next. And I think that's kind of fearful because, as you mentioned, back whenever the initial tariffs on China came, we lost those markets with soybeans. And they're still hurting at this point. So I think the fear is, like, we don't want to lose foreign markets because there's so much being there's so many crops and so many things that we could output. But if we lose those markets, then we just have a surplus with nowhere to go.
Right. Yeah. And nobody wants that.
Exactly.
And we mentioned China, but the markets we're talking about now that are of biggest concern might be Mexico and Canada. How important is Canada to South Dakota farmers and ranchers?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in South Dakota, it's really important. We have a lot of exports going out there. I think kind of the biggest question mark right now is kind of where they go with their next retaliatory tariffs. So right now, I don't think we're getting too hard from what I've understood and what I've gathered. But what I've kind of found is that the next round, there's a lot more uncertainty. So especially in the corn industry, a lot of people are worried because our top exports of yellow corn is to Mexico, number one, and then to Canada, number two. And so the worry is if they put that on there, that's going to hurt those markets a lot. And then another kind of aspect with that industry I'm seeing is with ethanol. So we're sending a lot of ethanol to Canada right now. And with those second round of tariffs that people don't know what's happening, that's on the chopping block as well as yellow corn. Specifically with Canada, they're kind of in like a public comment period right now with those tariffs where there's a lot of things that could go into effect next if they do have to retaliate. But we don't know what that looks like. So a lot of industries are just kind of stuck in limbo, especially in ag right now, where that would hurt us a lot here in South Dakota if it is put on certain things like corn.
Back to the uncertainty, making the best decision you can make now, but that might not be the best decision if you had the information that you might get 2 weeks or 2 months from now. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. We know how many people voted for President Donald Trump in South Dakota. We know how supportive a lot of people, not all farmers and producers, but a lot of farmers are very supportive of this president, and yet it's hurting them economically. Mm-hmm. And yet they still are trying to hang in there and say, like, you know, we do support what we're doing, but we can only hold on for so long. What do they want? What do farmers want from a president that they support?
I think that's a great question. I think, so initially, obviously said, farmers are pretty well in support, especially here in South Dakota, of President Trump. I think what they want is, obviously, a lot of people are fine with the negotiations. They want that certainty, and they're understanding that the tariffs, if they're used in a negotiation tactic way, it could be beneficial for the country. But I think what they also don't want is their markets to get lost, and that's kind of where the concern comes in. Like, as President Trump has said, is he's preached patience to the industry, and so I think at a certain point, patience gets scary, and a lot of people are scared because we don't know what's next. I talked a little bit about Canada and their retaliatory tariffs. As for Mexico, we don't know. They're keeping their cards kind of hold close to their chest, is what I've heard from them. So I think what farmers want is just some sort of foreign market to send all these exports to so that we can keep the economy growing and keep it strong in the ag industry, especially in South Dakota, where that's the number one industry and a big part of the economy. That's a pretty big concern, is just if we don't know what's going to happen, then how are we going to keeping the economy strong?
Yeah, and it's expensive for a federal government to provide the bailouts to farmers when they really want the markets instead. Yeah. You also, I want to just make sure before I let you go, coffee is going to go up. what did you find out about the coffee beans? How is that factoring in to this?
So that's actually a really interesting story, how I even came across that story. My mom's friend back in Illinois was, I'm assuming, complaining to someone about the cost of her coffee going up locally. And so then that company reached out to her and was just like, yeah, it's a lot of global stuff going on that's kind of compounding into this big local increase in coffee prices, which you wouldn't think about, but once you kind of connect the dots, it's causing like minor increases. So last year, Vietnam and Brazil were both going through like droughts and periods of drought. So they provide the most coffee of like any nations. Those two, I believe it's like 50% of the world's coffee output is from them.
Okay.
So there's less coffee than we had than normal. There's a lot of global shipping issues in the Red Sea right now. And so with the security issues, that's affecting trade, world trade, because it's like 30% of world trade goes through there. So if it's down, all world trade's going down. Mm. And so there's just like a lot of random global issues that are kind of affecting the price of coffee. So whenever you're a U.S. local coffee shop, you can only buy coffee in the States at Hawaii. That's the only place it's suitable to grow it.
Okay.
So all of your coffee markets are global. You have to buy globally. So then whenever there's all this global stuff happening, those prices are going to jack up. And then you as a local coffee shop have to buy coffee from somewhere. So those prices go up. And eventually, like at a certain point, you've had to trickle it down into your customers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. You wouldn't think that all these crazy things around the world are going to impact your coffee cup or your latte that you get downtown. But that's kind of what I've gathered is that it's pretty much everywhere across the state. Yeah. So
great reporting. We'll put some links up to Jackson's work online. Jackson Dirks, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lori.
Short-term rentals are likely a contributing factor to Rapid City's housing shortage. But as SDPB's Jackie Hendry reports, it's all a balancing act. Hendry is host of SDPB's monthly public affairs program. Its episode on South Dakota's rental properties premieres tomorrow. That's Thursday, March 27th at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV 1. Jackie Hendry has traveled the state for the story, but she sat down with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
Well, it's been a really interesting kind of investigation into, like you said, kind of that patchwork policy, because there are definitions in state statute about vacation home rentals and certain definitions of, you know, cleanliness and health and safety and all these things that would apply to short-term rentals, Airbnbs, that sort of thing. Not a lot of people are aware of those state regulations. And it's one of those things where there's not really a lot of teeth to it or like consequences if you don't go through the state licensing process, for instance, which would include a tour, an inspection of the property, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So to that end, we see municipalities, counties coming up with their own ordinances that they then enforce on the local level. And so that's why, you know, from county to county, community to community, you might have slightly different rules and regulations. Maybe over here, you don't need to go through any procedure to list as a short-term rental. Maybe over there, they want you to be licensed with the state. Maybe in this third community, they want, you know, a 200-foot buffer between you and the next short-term rental. And so depending on, you know, if you're a property manager, that can be frustrating. If you're a local citizen trying to find a house, maybe you want something in that realm. So it really varies community to community. And as the popularity of short-term rentals rises, more and more communities are taking notice of that and taking some local action.
Yeah. All right. So the people who are in this business have a lot to say about why it's good business for South Dakota. Tell me a little bit about some of the people that you met, the challenges that they're facing, but then also what they want people to know about how they're contributing, how their business is contributing to an economy.
Right. So we've got several voices in this episode with folks that run Airbnbs. Kristen Bennett, I'll point out, she started with a short-term rental in Britain and then moved to the Black Hills. Now she has a few properties out there. And, you know, we talked with her at this, you know, acreage in the Black Hills, this historic 1800s home that she has renovated and turned into a short-term rental. And so she hears concerns about, for instance, short-term rentals are taking homes off the market for families looking for that first-time home buyer property.
Yeah.
She says, look at this acreage. This is not a first-time home buyer property. Or you look into some of these historic neighborhoods in Rapid City, like the West Boulevard neighborhood, where there is a fairly large concentration of short-term rentals. People would point out those don't necessarily fall in that first-time home buyer budget space anyway.
Okay.
But the folks that own these Airbnbs would point out, you know, I'm local. I live here. This is a business. I, too, am part of this community. Oftentimes, we have another property manager point out most of his renters come from about a 200-mile radius, and then the off-tourism season, that's even smaller. It's local people enjoying these properties as well.
It's us going out to the Black Hills from Sioux Falls. Yeah.
I am one of those people.
You've stayed in these places,
And so that, you know, we're talking millions of dollars, plus, by the way, sales taxes. If you list with Airbnb or Vrbo, those two sites have agreements with South Dakota to remit those sales taxes. It is a multi-million dollar economic, you know, influx into these communities, yeah, would be the argument of folks that own these properties.
Shout out to Jim Hagan, who told us to take vacation in our own state.
Yes, exactly.
He didn't tell us where, he did not tell us where to stay.
Right.
But he did encourage all of us to go out and explore. Okay, so, but then short-term rentals can also be a very convenient monster under the bed because the inventory is low, because mm-hmm. if you're looking in a certain neighborhood and you realize you can't buy the house next to the house that you, or you, you won't have neighbors, you'll have an ongoing people coming in and out. Mm-hmm. What are some of the criticisms of this industry, especially as it grows in this patchwork of regulatory way?
Right, especially as it grows, I'll point particularly in those like deep in the hills communities where development is limited by basic geography. I mean, you're not mm-hmm. really blasting right. into the granite of the hills. You might be surrounded by federal forest land. So the existing homes are kind of what you have for stock for your community. And then there might be short-term rentals kind of spreading out into those residential areas. Yeah. So some folks have concerns about that. Or communities might be like, hey, how are we supposed to grow and subsist our maybe aging population or a young population to avoid them moving out of the community if there's no homes for them? So yeah. it's kind of this catch-22 of supply plus affordability, this idea of neighborhood cohesion. And right. again, that West Boulevard neighborhood in Rapid City, you have some folks that have some consternation towards that because of the revolving door visitors, and you don't really know who's coming and going and that sort of thing. What I did hear, you know, there are worries about trash, about parking, about party homes. In Rapid City, the number of actual complaints for noise, for trash, for things like this when it came to short-term rentals, very small compared to the hundreds of listings that there are.
Okay.
So maybe proportional to what's happening, not as big of a deal as maybe there might be fears that it would be a big deal.
Yeah.
But those are some of the concerns we hear from the locals. But mostly it's that I want to know who my neighbor is and I want my kid to be able to buy a house.
Yeah.
But that affordability piece is not so... There's some relationship with short-term rentals. There have been studies that as property managers improve the homes, the value of properties around them goes up, which sure. can impact pricing.
Yeah.
But it's kind of one piece of the puzzle. And there's not a lot of evidence that, for instance, banning short-term rentals outright would solve the problem that those people are most concerned about.
Yeah. And in that this tension again with the economy and saying, oh, this is my neighborhood, but now it's your business, but it's my neighborhood. Mm. We're seeing that push and pull between neighbors.
Right.
Are there ideas for solutions? Are there ideas for like understanding how big the problem is? Is it a problem? What are some of the ways to look to the future and see what we might see in a state legislature or in the city of Rapid, for example?
I think it comes down to just broader communication and getting outside of there is that almost stigma in some parts of the state of right. us versus them. And I think there's more common ground than people would realize as they dig into the dirt of it.
Yeah. The bottom line also of, is short-term rental growth impacting the inventory for affordable housing for people who want to live here, whether they want to stay after graduating from high school or college, or whether someone new comes to town and wants to work in a, you know, working class job. And what I'm hearing you saying is they intersect, they bump up against each other, but no, you can't blame one for the other.
Right, exactly. I think there is definitely that impact on stock, but also just the fact that, for instance, again, Rapid City, you're not developing at the same rate that you were of new home, single home, you know, construction as you were maybe.
Right. So getting rid of
short-term
housing is not going to solve your problem.
No.
This is going to be a problem that is addressed through people talking, through policies, mm-hmm. through...
It might free up a handful of residences on a street, but it's not going to solve the holistic issue of affordable housing in the Black Hills.
You can watch the latest episode of South Dakota Focus on SDPB TV1 on Thursday, March 27th. That's at 8 p.m. Central and 7 p.m. Mountain Time. And of course, you can find all the South Dakota Focus episodes on our YouTube channel and on Facebook. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.